medical home guidelines and nurse practitioners, trauma patients and increased mortality rates, the NLN and a living document on academic progression in nursing, and we're going to take a look at CNS stimulants in this week's episode. If that's what you're looking for, you found it. It's The Nursing Show. Well, good day and welcome to this week's episode of The Nursing Show. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, and I'd like to welcome you to this episode this week, recorded in our new studio setup. We're still kind of working out the bugs down here, so please bear with us. But I've been building this studio here at the Medicast Productions location for quite some time, and we finally got the studio set up kind of in the way we want to get it working. So we're moving from our old location where we were recording, and we're now in our new studio location. And it's a little nicer setup and gives us a little more ability to do some different things as we roll down the road. So welcome here to the show this week. I do want to remind you to check out all of the information and updates about this episode, what's going on in the field of nursing, and more over at nursingshow.com. You'll find links there for the show notes for each episode, also links for student nurse tips and study aids, a little bit of information on what the nursing show is about, and of course, more information about what's going on with nursing. We update articles all throughout the course of the week, along with, of course, our weekly show that comes out every Friday. So check all that out, available for you over at nursingshow.com. You can also always get back in touch with me. I love to hear from you, so send in emails with comments, suggestions for future episodes, perhaps links you'd like to share for news items or tips of the week. And of course, if I make a mistake, definitely send in those corrections. You can get all of those into me here by sending an email to nursingshow@gmail.com, and I will get back to you. I work really hard to make sure I return all the emails. It might take me a few days to get back to you, but I will return your email and let you know I got it, and perhaps even share some comments from your email here on the show. And I really look forward to the opportunity to interact with you via email and other things. Of course, those other things could be Twitter or Facebook. You can find me under the handle PodMedic at Twitter and Facebook, twitter.com/PodMedic and facebook.com/PodMedic. And don't forget the Nursing Show fan page, all available for you over at Facebook. That's facebook.com/nursingshow. And it's your way to check in with what's going on. I put updates there, sometimes some video additions, links to other things going on Facebook and beyond. A little bit different mix than what I might put over at the Nursing Show website. So if you're active on Facebook, it's a great way to keep up with what's going on over there. And I hope you'll follow up on that. We're going to get into the show now with our news items coming up next, but I do want to remind you to make sure you support our sponsors here at The Nursing Show so we can keep The Nursing Show coming out each week free for you. Just visit their websites and show your support by stopping by and seeing what they have to offer. It helps support the show. It helps show them that you're interested in keeping The Nursing Show here going, and spend a few minutes supporting the sponsors is a great way to show your support for The Nursing Show. Let's jump into this week's news items, and I'm going to start off with a look at an article I found this week on new medical home guidelines. Now, what do I talk about? Am I talking about people getting treated in their homes? No. Actually, I'm talking about where are our patients finding their primary source of care? Where is the home of their medical source of primary care? The medical home concept is something that was put forth in the recent guidelines for changes to our healthcare system and part of our healthcare reform program put in place a few years ago as part of the new federal initiatives. And part of it says that patients should have a medical home. Now, there is some controversy associated with this because nurse practitioners, advanced practice nurses, want to be included as being a source for that medical home, that primary care. And with the Institute of Medicine report and other initiatives saying basically that nurse practitioners should be allowed to practice to the full extent of their training and be able to operate independently of a physician oversight, that would seem to make a lot of sense. However, Not surprisingly, the four biggest groups of physician organizations, the four groups of physicians that represent most primary care professionals, including the American Family Physicians and the Ambulatory Care and others, are all saying basically that this should be only physician-directed, that the medical home of every patient should be a physician's office, and that they're out from there, they can be delegated to be under care of an advanced practice nurse if needed. And this is just going to be interesting as it gets worked out. Now, the organizations that are working on this right now, the groups that accredit or recognize practices as medical homes, include the National Committee for Quality Assurance, the Accreditation Association for Ambulatory Healthcare, and URAC, formerly known as the Utilization Review Accreditation Commission. And there will also be the Joint Commission will be joining that. For those of you that are in the hospital setting, you come to know and love the Joint Commission. The guidelines that are working with these other physician groups, the Association for Ambulatory Healthcare agrees with the primary care medical providers, the medical physicians, and say that it should be a physician in charge. However, all of the other organizations leave the door open to nurse practitioners either currently in practice independently in those states that allow independent nurse practitioner practice, or in the case of some of the organizations, leaving it open by defining medical homes as clinician-led. So not defining it as a physician, but as a clinician, which of course leaves the door open to add other types of healthcare professionals to that medical home for those that seek it. And this is going to be an interesting issue, and I thought I would bring this up here on the show because this does affect those of you that are perhaps working towards an advanced practice degree in nursing, hopefully working towards being an independent care provider yourself, and also those of you that might be working with nurse practitioners and wanting to be part of that medical home practice with a nursing scope and a nursing focus. So it'll be interesting to see how this works out, and I wanted to make sure that we included this on the show. Let's move on to the next item, and we're going to look at a study from the March 9th issue of the Journal of the American Medical Association, which looked at trauma patients and the fact that they had an increased mortality rate when they had been discharged from the hospital up to 3 years later. Now, obviously, people that have been into a trauma center are there for various severe trauma, multi-system trauma from a motor vehicle accident, gunshot wounds, stabbings, industrial accidents, all causing them to have increased risk immediately of death and significant disability. But what about their risk for dying from related or other medical issues later on? Does this multi-system trauma to their bodies put them at increased risk for death in general later in life? And this particular study followed people out to the 3-year mark, and it found that even at 3 years, they had an increased risk of dying. Over that 3-year time frame, 16% of the patients that were followed had died, as opposed to the expected rate of 6% for these patients. And that's significant. And so I would like to address a little bit about what this means to us in the field when we're talking about trauma to our patients and perhaps taking history, whether we're working in the emergency department, primary care setting, clinic, or in the hospital setting, we should get a good handle on our patient's past medical history. If you have a patient, for instance, that's in the hospital for a gallbladder surgery, and you find out that they had a major motor vehicle accident and were in a trauma center for a week, 2 years ago, you should be understanding that this could put them at increased risk for complications to their present surgery, their present hospitalization. Not really sure why. They're looking at a number of different reasons why these patients were, why these particular patients had increased risk farther down the road, but certainly adhesions, internal scarring related to the injury itself, as well as surgeries, causes their anatomy to be a little more difficult to navigate during surgical procedures, causes them to have perhaps reduced function in some of their body systems, which puts them at increased risk, and so should put you at a heightened awareness to monitor these patients and assess them, and be aware of the fact that there could be some things cropping up that cause them to have increased risk factors for infection, complications following surgery, perhaps recovery. And in the primary care setting, obviously, keeping track of these patients and keeping them at optimal health levels is going to improve their health. So this could put them in an increased risk due to obesity, due to diabetes, to heart disease, anything else that could put additional strain on their bodies. The previous strain of this major injury and trauma hospitalization could compromise their ability to compensate for other health problems later on. So I just point this out to you. It's something to keep in mind, and certainly we're going to be following this. I'm very interested, of course, because of my emergency background. I'm curious as to multi-system trauma and how it affects patients later in life, even 3 years and beyond. Are we finding that these people are at increased risk for other problems down the road? Finally, a brief look here at the National League for Nursing, the NLN, which is actively involved in the academic accreditation and setting standards for the training of our new nurses and increasing academic standing for our nurses that are moving forward in their degrees. And I just wanted to point out to you and include a link in the show notes to a recent release from the National League for Nursing, the NLN, coming out with a living document that basically, this living document will be updated and changed and adjusted, but it is focusing on the academic progression options for all nurses. This has been a hot button topic, where is, of course, the entry level for basic nursing care, and we can certainly talk about that as something that could be considered at many different levels. There currently is in the United States the associate's degree nurse, the ADN, that is the basic standard, minimum standard for registered nurse. But there is a push to bring all nurses up to the bachelor's degree level. And should that be the minimum starting standard, or at least a standard to which all nurses aspire within a short time of becoming nurses, even at the ADN level? So something that's being discussed. But this particular document focuses on exactly how nurses are going to move forward in their careers and in their education. And so this focuses on advancing to BSN, to master's degree in studies in the master's level, graduate studies of various kinds, advanced practice nursing, and beyond. So certainly we need to be considering these things. If you're considering advancing your academic standing as a nurse, you might want to take a look at this document, understand some of the things that it's pushing out to the academic community, and understand some of the ways that it might help increase your focus on exactly what it is you're trying to do by understanding what the leaders of our academic side of nursing are trying to do to bring forward a way to support and improve the nursing career path and profession for all of us. And I always try to put these links out there because I want to make sure that each of you understands what our leaders are doing for us at the national level. You know, the American Nurses Association, the NLN, and other organizations do a lot behind the scenes, and we don't often understand how they are representing each and every one of us. And we may not always agree with the stands they take, but in this situation, this is really focusing on each nurse reaching a level of academic standing that helps them be the best that they can possibly be, whether that's bachelor's degree, even if it's an ADN nurse that's aspiring to receive some advanced certification in as a clinical specialist of some kind. These are things that are standing out there for everyone to pay attention to, and I urge you to check this link out in the show notes. You'll find that link, of course, in the show notes over at nursingshow.com. Time now for this week's tip of the week, and I'm going to be looking at central nervous system stimulants, CNS stimulants. This is part of our continuing series looking at most commonly prescribed medications. Found a list of commonly prescribed medications by age group over at the Centers for Disease Control site in a study that they have out on prescription medications. And we've recently covered the use of albuterol and other beta agonists or airway medications in previous look of this study for younger children. And I thought it was time for us to look forward here at those next level of patients in the realm, and this is school-age children through age 19, those pediatric, school-age pediatric patients. And for those of us that are parents or people involved in the education system, the number of children that are receiving some form of central nervous system stimulant as a result of an ADHD diagnosis, an ADD diagnosis, or something like that, certainly will understand exactly why this is a most commonly prescribed medication for that age group. But it does mean that we're going to see a lot of patients, especially if you're in a pediatric setting, an emergency department setting, and it helps to understand exactly what goes on with these patients and exactly what you might expect to see when you have these types of patients come in. Perhaps they've taken too much of the medication. Perhaps you have to send them home with the medication and you're providing them education. What kind of drug interactions do need to be worried about? What kind of side effects might be of concern? All of that is important nursing instruction we provide for our patients. So let's look at central nervous system stimulants on this tip of the week here at the Nursing Show. So let's look at central nervous system stimulants in this series on commonly prescribed medications for the Nursing Show. We'll be looking at a couple of different things. We'll be, of course, looking at what central nervous system stimulants we are talking about in this class of medications. We'll also discuss some of the common indications for these meds, warnings and precautions, as always, things to keep in mind with these medications, some of the common side effects for the class of medications. We won't be looking at specific drugs in the class, but there are some things that are typical and common with medications that are in this class. And then, of course, nursing considerations, things that you need to keep in mind when you have patients that are prescribed this medication, you're treating patients who are taking this medication, follow-up care, and patient education issues. When we talk about central nervous system stimulants, the effects that these medications have in pediatric patients, as we're talking about those applications specifically in this commonly prescribed medication series, we're looking at how these stimulants seem to act as dopamine agonists in the central nervous system. There's some discussion in different class, different types of these medications work in different ways. They either act as dopamine reuptake inhibitors, or they act as actually causing an increasing dopamine release, as well as perhaps in some areas reducing dopamine reuptake. So depending on the different medications, they may either be acting on the release side of dopamine, increasing dopamine release, or they are decreasing the reuptake of the dopamine neurotransmitter and causing that dopamine to be more accessible and usable by the central nervous system. There are several medications that fall into this class and are used in this category. Methylphenidate, MPH, commonly known as Ritalin. The D-amphetamine, which is AMP, dexedrine. Also a combination of D and L-amphetamine, and that is the drug Adderall. And there are extended release versions of some of these medications now. These stimulants are considered class 2 controlled substances, so there are prescribing restrictions on these medications. In many cases, some of the common restrictions on nurse practitioners in some states include that they are not allowed to prescribe class 2 medications, making them ineffective in some as practitioners for primary care for pediatric patients, for instance, because they can't prescribe these commonly prescribed meds. And it really restricts their access to these medications and being able to help their patients effectively. So these central nervous system stimulants do fall into that category. So what are the common indications? Well, we've talked a little bit about it. Treatment of behavioral disorders in pediatric patients, commonly attention deficit and hyperactivity disorder, attention deficit disorder, and that's ADD versus the hyperactivity disorder version, ADHD, and also in mostly in adults, narcolepsy. And so these are the common indications that are seen for these medications. Of course, these medications can be abused, and that leads us into some of the common precautions and warnings. There is a real high potential for abuse in these medications. They can cause dependency issues when used over a prolonged period of time, and they over long periods of time, and especially when overused or abused, can cause adverse cardiovascular events, including sudden cardiac death, hypertension, and other adverse events, arrhythmias and things like that. So there certainly needs to be oversight, and it's one of the reasons these medications are placed in the class 2 controlled substances, because they need to be monitored and maintained effectively. Does that mean that nurses can't do that? Absolutely not. I don't believe so. But this is, again, one of those things that in many cases is not allowed. Nurses are not allowed to commonly prescribe these medications in the advanced practice setting. And so it is something to be considered. Just to be aware, when you take these medications with foods containing acids, such as fruit juices, citric juices and things like that, basically reduce the effectiveness of these medications, or reduce absorption of the medication when taken at the same time. Conversely, if you take these medications with an alkalinizing agent, such as an antacid, you can actually cause these medications to be absorbed too quickly. And so it's important to be aware that that is a concern, and to make sure that you are making sure that the patients understand when and how to take the medications effectively. There are some drug interactions, some of them kind of severe, so you need to be aware. The MAOIs, the monoamine oxidase inhibitors, antihypertensive medications, and others can have their effects either potentiated or cause harmful side effects. And there are other drug interactions, quite a list of them. So when you have patients taking these meds, make sure you're using your drug interaction calculators or your drug guides to make sure you're monitoring that your patients aren't taking another med that could be cause a contraindication. And it's important to monitor that. And also to check with your patients as they come back. Maybe another physician has prescribed something that causes you to now be contraindicated to be taking any of these CNS stimulants. So again, don't always assume that the patient knows that. Don't always assume that the other prescribing practitioner knows that there is a drug conflict. You need to be following up as well, and that's just good patient care, but always make sure you're taking that history of any changes in their medical history since the last time you've seen them, if they are a regular primary care patient or you've seen them before in your facility. Some of the common side effects associated with central nervous system stimulants are probably not surprising, include palpitations, tachycardia, hypertension. There may be restlessness, dizziness, depression. The patient may complain of tremor or headaches. There may be tics associated, nervous system tics associated with these particular classes of medications. And it is important to note that, you know, if you have a patient with a history of tics, Tourette's syndrome or anything like that, that these medications will potentiate those disorders and may cause increased side effects from those disorders by potentiating their effects. Patients may also complain of dry mouth, diarrhea. Anorexia and weight loss are not uncommon. If you think about it, in adult settings, the central nervous system stimulants are often used to assist in weight loss. And so, no different in children, they lose some of the common urges to notice that they're hungry. And so they tend to go right through meals and not feel like they're very hungry and eat less food. It is important to note that a lot of studies have looked at this, that the children who are taking these medications tend to lag behind, lose some weight, lag behind in growth. However, it is a lagging behind. It has been shown in numerous studies that they do reach full potential growth, but that it's delayed for several years. So if they were going to reach full height at the age of, in the case of a female, perhaps 15 to 16, that patient may reach their full height 16 or 17, maybe even 18. But they do reach full potential height, but these medications seem to have a slowing effect. So it is important to notice that is the case. Also, patients that suddenly stop taking these medications after they've taken it for a long time could experience some withdrawal symptoms. Again, we talked about the dependency potential for these medications. So they may have a sudden onset of really severe fatigue, for a period of time, and they may experience depression. So it's important to monitor your patients, let them know that they need to not just stop taking the medications, they need to contact somebody and perhaps wean themselves off of these medications more slowly to, or at least be prepared for the potential for side effects associated with withdrawal. Some nursing considerations to keep in mind as we wrap things up. Again, just to review, don't take with acidic foods and don't take with antacids because they're going to either reduce absorption of the medication, causing lower than normal blood levels, or it may actually potentiate absorption, causing the blood levels to spike rather quickly in patients. Also, things that cause acidification or alkalinization of the urinary tract can cause the reverse effect. So we actually end up holding on to them medication a little bit longer or potentiate the excretion and therefore cause blood levels to again remain low. So just keep that in mind. Double check for drug interactions. As I said, there are a lot of drug interactions listed and just too many to go over here when there's so many medications in the class, but I would urge you to make sure that you're following up on drug interactions both before giving the patient these medications and also as an ongoing process during patient care as they continue to take the medications. Because of the side effects, you want to monitor patients' vital signs and also take regular weights on these patients. Find out if they're losing weight. I mean, obviously, if they lose weight and they're down to a more optimal weight anyway, it's a positive thing. In an area where children are more and more obese, we find that the children that are taking these medications tend not to be so much. However, it doesn't mean that we're doing this to cause weight loss, and we want to monitor if they start falling below optimal weight levels for their body size. We need to be aware of that and encourage the parents to find ways to increase their caloric intake if these drugs are suppressing their appetites. Monitor your vital signs, obviously their pulse, blood pressure. Really important to monitor these because we want to monitor for any cardiovascular side effects. Liver and kidney function labs, just to monitor so that these drugs are safely metabolized and excreted. Anything that reduces liver and kidney function could reduce the ability of the body to get rid of this medication, causing increased levels in the blood. So again, we need to monitor for that. And so a lot of patients taking these medications may have periodic blood tests along with them, perhaps every couple of months, perhaps at least once a year. And that needs to be something that may be monitored from time to time. They're in inpatient setting. Just monitor along with drug interactions to make sure that there's not any potentiation side effects. Typically, a patient in the hospital inpatient setting will not be taking their CNS stimulants because they're usually taking them for school purposes, and so they don't often take them when they're not specifically going to be attending school or in a setting where they need to be applying themselves to learning. So that's probably not something they're taking while in your facility. But a child in a long-term care setting perhaps needs to continue classes, and it may be something that is continued while in inpatient care for certain conditions, and it's something to be aware of. Parent education is paramount. Again, educate the parents about some of the things like weight loss, potential growth slowing, but to encourage parents to understand how this is a common treatment for patients with certain behavioral problems, but that there are other things that go along with it. Obviously, the medication seems to work very well, but behavior modification, counseling, and therapy are also important side conduits to go along with this treatment, co-treatments with the medications in many cases. So educate the parents. Educate the parents to make sure that they know how many pills are in the house. These drugs are commonly abused, and so people from outside of the home may find these medications and take them. So you need to be aware of, encourage them to be aware of how many pills are in the bottle, that they're being taken responsibly, and that someone else isn't taking them and perhaps distributing them to people who do not have the medication prescribed. So because this is a controlled substance and a class 2 controlled substance, it needs to be monitored carefully. There are good references available in the show notes, links that you can follow up on, and I urge you to do that. Find those links in the show notes over at nursingshow.com. and follow up on them. Lots of good resources, including patient education materials, as well as materials for you, the medical and healthcare professionals. And hopefully this will be able to encourage you to be a little more knowledgeable about this particular class of medications as we continue this ongoing series on some of the most commonly prescribed meds seen in our patients' med lists. And that's going to wrap up this week's episode of The Nursing Show. I want to thank everybody for checking out the show this week and remind all of you to check out nursingshow.com, where you'll find links to everything discussed in this episode in the news items, additional resources for the tip of the week segment, and of course, information on how to get back in touch with me, whether you want to contact me by leaving a comment over on The Nursing Show site or want to reach out to me through my other resources. All of that's available over at nursingshow.com. You can always send me an email. Send those emails in to nursingshow@gmail.com. And don't forget, you can also catch up with me via Twitter or Facebook. Twitter.com/podmedic and Facebook.com/podmedic are the ways you can find me over there. And the Nursing Show fan page available for you over on Facebook as well. Facebook.com/nursingshow. Going to go ahead and get wrapped up here on the show and look forward to seeing you next week. But we're going to close out with some PodSafe music. This is a song we've played before by an artist by the name of Samuel Ventura called Strawberry Soda. I hope you like it. If you like the music and want to check it out, there's a link in the show notes to find his music over in iTunes. And I would urge you to check out his songs. And if you like what you hear, pick up a song or two and show your support for this PodSafe music artist who shares his music with people like you and myself via podcasts like The Nursing Show. That's it. I'm Jamie Davis. I'll be back again next week with another episode of The Nursing Show. In the meantime, I want to remind all of you to stay safe and stay tuned here to The Nursing Show. Take care.
Pick a star from the big and black sky. Make a wish, but don't aim too high. Expectations leave you waiting round. I've been waiting, being pretty patient. Known invitations upon champagne and this girl's gonna make me lose my mind. And then I wrote her, told her to come over. We'll drink Coca-Cola, strawberry soda, and we'll talk about our stupid lives. My life's been exactly how my night's been. A little lonely, but I feel alright when I get around to pouring myself a drink. Na 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 na. Well, I've got a feeling today is gonna be alright.
Talk about our stupid lives.
Na 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 na.
glass sky. Make a wish, but don't aim too high. Nothing ever seems to go my way.